I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
And welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer. And each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And there is a website for the show, which you can access at radioinvivo.net. You can get to all of our past programs there on the website on the wide variety of topics we've featured, so we hope you'll check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes, and we also have podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. And you are listening to WCOM LPFM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. And this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to meet two of the Triangle's, I think it's safe to say, brightest young scientists, and hear all about some very important contributions they've made in the field of structural biology. Dr. Matt Redenbaugh is a professor and vice chair of the Department of Chemistry at UNC Chapel Hill and has a joint appointment in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at the UNC School of Medicine. He is also director of structural biology at the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. His lab is devoted to macromolecular crystallography, and we're going to hear about that. Among his awards are the Burroughs Wellcome Career Award in the Biomedical Sciences and the UNC Hettleman Prize for Artistic and Scholarly Achievement. Matt received his B.S. in biochemistry in 1990 from the University of California, Davis, and his Ph.D. in biochemistry from UCLA in 1995. And also joining us is Scott Lujan. Scott is a graduate student in Matt's lab, and he received his undergraduate degree from the University of Pittsburgh. Is that correct? Okay, good. And as we will hear, Scott has already done some pretty remarkable stuff under Matt's mentorship. Matt and Scott, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much, Ernie.
Gentlemen, I would like to start our discussion today by talking about your recent discovery and publication that first brought your work to my attention regarding antibiotic resistance. I think most of our listeners have probably heard about the public health crisis due to growing resistance by many pathogens to the most commonly used antibiotics. Of course, it's especially serious in the hospital setting. I got some stats to put it in context for our listeners. According to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, right now more than 70% of the bacteria that cause hospital-acquired infections are resistant to at least one of the antibiotics most commonly used to treat them. And hospital-acquired infections kill an estimated 100,000 people per year. And, of course, we're now seeing more and more antibiotic resistance in community-acquired infections as well. Matt, up to this point, what approaches have been taken to try to combat this growing problem as it's contributing to the reemergence or strengthening of these infectious diseases we thought we had pretty much conquered?
Well, I think that the major issue here is that antibiotics have been a very successful historical treatment for these types of infectious diseases. And I think in some ways it's a failure of success. In other words, we got very used to sort of from the 1940s on, you know, standard bacterial infections were treatable using, you know, a variety of compounds eventually, starting with penicillin and then moving on to other things as well. So we've really enjoyed that sort of breakthrough. In fact, the discovery of penicillin was certainly one of the hallmark events in human history in terms of, the many more people survived the Second World War due to our ability to treat the infections that that accompanied the wounds that they received. So we all got very used to that, and the pharmaceutical industry did a fantastic job of providing a lot of compounds that that turned into drugs and were successful. But what we didn't sort of keep our eye on, at least during the first 40 years of antibiotic use, was that even within 10 years, penicillin was being, resistance to penicillin was being observed in the clinics. And those were things that, we didn't really want to believe was going to be a big problem, and it turned out to be a problem. So what's happened is, we've had a lot of good drugs that that were effective. In 1970, many people considered bacterial infections to be a solved problem. And so a lot of our best scientists sort of moved on to other things and focused on other issues like cancer and things like that. And, you know, the bacteria didn't take this lightly. So they started fighting us back and saying, well, you know, we're not going to take this chemical threat lying down. And so they found ways to get around it. Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing is just, as you say, you know, more and more resistant infections, 70% in hospital-acquired infections. The 100,000 people a year that die of bacterial infections in hospitals is actually twice the number of deaths each year from breast cancer. So this is a significant problem, and that's in this country where, we're doing a pretty good job of trying to treat these things. That's not even thinking internationally. So, we've in our lab thought a lot about, you know, how can we contribute to this problem and think about, you know, understanding how resistance propagates and then maybe how to use that understanding to address it.
I see. Well, now I'd like to get you to tell us about your recent discovery of a possible chink in the armor of antibiotic resistance. You actually took a pretty out-of-the-box approach to this, didn't you? Focusing on the mechanism of the process itself, right? And both of you feel free to jump in here.
Sure. So I'll start a little bit here. So the main way that bacteria become resistant to antibiotics is they pass genes directly between bacterial cells, and that's called bacterial conjugation. Mm-hmm. So,
and I understand that is the microbial equivalent of mating.
It really is. And so they do it because they don't reproduce sexually. So they don't have the chance to get additional genes and gene shuffling that happens when sexual reproduction is used. So what they do is they pass genes around using this approach, and that gives them ways to achieve genetic diversity. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that they pass are virulence factors. Those are things that make them tougher than their neighbors, more likely to survive. Mm-hmm. And they also pass antibiotic resistance genes, and it's another way that sort of helps them survive.
I see. So this is really evolution in action in the very short term, right?
Absolutely. That's right.
My friends at the Evolutionary Synthesis Center will be so happy I asked for that.
So the thing is, we really got into this just wanting to understand how this gene movement occurred. And, you know, that's a basic scientific question, and we were certainly very focused on that. Mm-hmm. In the long term, we thought, well, it would be really great if we could understand that and then disrupt it, and that would stop the spread of the resistance. What we found to our delight is that we could disrupt it, and not only did it stop the spread, but it also selectively killed bacteria that harbored these resistance-type genes.
So let's bring Scott in at this point. Scott, you were the one who made the kind of leap, correct me if I'm wrong here, on how to actually do something about this process, that you saw how this worked through the structural work, I assume, and made that intellectual connection. Can you tell us that story?
Well, the way it actually worked out was there are a couple of competing labs, one in Baltimore and one in Spain, that had solved similar structures in the past. But they had gotten snapshots of different parts of the chemical reaction that takes place on these enzymes. And what we ended up with is a different snapshot. And that really helped complete our picture. And so from the different snapshots, we could intuit the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And once we had the mechanism, we could pick out the one piece of the chronology that we could try to mimic. And that's how we came up with our inhibitors.
I see. So this involves an enzyme called DNA relaxase.
That's right.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right.
Good. Tell us a little bit more about that, how you focused in on that as really the site of a possible target.
So the DNA relaxase is actually it's sort of the keystone of the whole conjugative system. The DNA relaxase is actually the enzyme that prepares the transmissible genetic element for transfer from one bacterial cell to another. It does that through a catalytic process that creates a nick in the backbone of the DNA itself in a very specific manner.
Mm-hmm.
So it nicks a certain portion of that DNA and then actually can help in transferring that to the recipient cell. And it's that nick that helps both initiate the process and eventually to terminate the process that we thought we could stop, because you don't need interactions with any other proteins to do that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So all we had was one very specific target, and all we had to do was look at that.
I see. And how did you decide that these biphosphonate drugs, which I understand are actually osteoporosis drugs, how did you decide that those might be effective inhibitors of this particular process?
So once we intuited the mechanism from the structural snapshots, we realized that there was one intermediate step of the mechanism in which there were two closely spaced phosphate groups within the active site of the enzyme. And it just so happens that a couple of these clinically approved compounds have the phosphate groups that are precisely the right distance, mm-hmm, to plug that hole.
So you knew enough chemically and biochemically to see this feature in the structure of this process, and to know enough that, hey, there's something out there that can inhibit this.
So
was there a eureka moment involved with all of this?
There sort of was, but it was kind of convoluted. There are a lot of great tools out there right now. So I had never heard of bisphosphonates before we started this project.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing what I was looking for as far as the specific intermediate, I could use a bunch of online tools to try to find compounds that looked like what I envisioned the intermediate to look like. And so just through that, it kind of fell out. And I think I actually remember the day that it happened, running in to tell Matt. And that was a good day.
I'll bet that was pretty exciting. You know, because this seems so fortuitous that there were compounds already in existence and available, let alone FDA approved already, to work on this, as opposed to having to say, okay, we've identified a target here, let's go to, you know, the typical drug development process at that point, which is, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and high throughput screening and combinatorial chemistry and, you know, all the rest. That you had this right there, and that you guys were intuitive enough to know that you had that right there.
In part, we were very lucky, but in part, because we had the structures, once we got enough snapshots, it was perhaps inevitable that somebody would eventually find the right point in that reaction to inhibit.
Mm-hmm. Matt, let's bring you back in. I understand that we haven't told the whole story yet, that there was also a pretty big surprise that emerged from the experiments with these drugs. Can you fill us in on that?
Sure. So really to sort of follow up on what Scott was saying, what we took instead of a sort of typical drug discovery approach was more of a bottom-up approach. In other words, understand how this protein functions. Mm-hmm. And then Scott made this wonderful prediction that these bisphosphonates would be inhibitors. And so we had that prediction and we went to test it. And the first thing we did was test it in a test tube with a purified enzyme, and it worked beautifully, really effective. And so that was wonderful because it also validated our hypothesis that those two phosphate intermediates really mattered.
Sure.
So that was wonderful. And then we went and tested it in cells. And we asked, okay, could we prevent the transfer of these resistance genes in a cellular assay between two bacterial cells? And we could do that, and that was great. Then came the surprise, which was even if these cells aren't mating, in other words, if you take only cells that just have these mobile elements and they're not mating with any other cells, if you treat them with the same drugs, those cells die. In other words, disrupting this process, even in non-mating cells, is lethal.
So the process does not have to be active, just the cell has to be ready to do it.
So really what it is that the process is active even when they're not mating.
This
protein's nicking the DNA and sealing it and nicking it and sealing it, ready to go. Mm-hmm. And if you hit it with this drug, it traps it in that nicked state. And then what we know from a lot of other studies is that when you disrupt DNA manipulation, the cell tends to die. And it's because it just can't handle that really sensitive intermediate, which is the DNA nicked state. You know, if you nick your DNA, you're asking, for trouble. And what happens is the cell doesn't survive. And so that's wonderful. So it has the potential to do two great things in the clinic. That is, one, prevent resistance from spreading to the neighbors, but also just purge any bacterial population of the resistant bacteria by just killing them. And so we're quite enthusiastic about that possibility.
Well, that was certainly my next question. Isn't enough what you've described to actually control an infection in and of itself, more or less replacing antibiotics, or does it simply, as you say, wipe out the transfer of resistance?
So it has the potential to act as an antibiotic on its own.
Okay.
And so that's quite wonderful. It also could be used in combination with existing antibiotics.
In other words, cocktail type of thing.
That's right. That's right. In fact, that's used. That's used in cancer quite frequently. It's used in HIV treatments quite frequently. So, those kind of cocktails. If you purge the population of the resistant bugs, then you can also give an existing antibiotic, and that antibiotic will now become more effective because you've already purged the ones that are resistant to that drug.
So it increases the potency of present antibiotics. Could it, I know that some of the antibiotics have practically, fallen out of use because of this resistance problem that has become so very common. Could this end up kind of restoring the potency and efficacy of some of those present antibiotics?
That is certainly our hope. That's definitely what we're thinking about, and those are actually experiments we're doing ongoing right now.
I see. So we could potentially turn back the clock and re-energize some of these drugs.
That's exactly what we're hoping.
As opposed to needing to find new ones or new classes of antibiotics.
That's right, although we should say that certainly finding new classes of antibiotics is just as important. So we're quite in favor of that as well.
Absolutely. Well, this is very exciting, and I've really been looking forward to having you guys on to talk about it. Where does all of this stand at present? I know that it was several months ago that you published the initial paper on this. Have you started other rounds of experiments, and are there any results that you can share at this time?
Sure. So this is, obviously an active project in the laboratory. So one of the first things we went to do then was see whether or not we could kill these bacteria in animals, which is obviously one of the next most important steps in a drug discovery pathway. Mm-hmm. And what we picked was actually a pretty neat system. So what we picked was what's called a notobiotic mouse system. And these are mice.
Notobiotic.
Okay. So these are mice that are delivered by C-section, and they're kept in sterile conditions, and so they don't have any bacteria in their GI tract. In fact, people should be reminded that we actually have 10 times more bacterial cells living in us and on us than we have human cells. So
right.
We really are symbiotes, and so are all.
And could not survive without that.
Absolutely true. And so these mice, you know, have these sort of pristine GI tracts, and so you can populate them with whatever bacteria you want.
I see.
And so that's what we did. We populated them with these resistant bacteria in their GI tracts, and then we treated them with these clinically approved drugs in their drinking water. And so it's wonderful. So you can get the drug right into the GI tract where the infection is.
Sure.
And then, you know, we call this sort of the crappiest project in the lab because what happens is then you have to collect the samples of the bacteria, and the way you do that is on the other end of the mouse.
Number two part of the experiment.
That's right.
That's got to be Scott's job. He's a grad student. He gets...
there are actually many people involved in this. And so then you take that and you just measure how many bacteria are in those samples, in the number two phase of the project. And what we're finding is that we're actually treating these infections in the GI tract very potently.
Really?
Using these drugs, yeah.
Okay, and any visible side effects? I mean, these drugs obviously are potent drugs in and of themselves. What kind of profile do they have typically?
So in these mice, they're pretty safe. So we haven't seen any adverse effects. You know, the mice are perfectly healthy. They're not losing weight. Everything's going fine. We chose this approach because we knew that the drugs weren't absorbed from the GI tract very well. So whatever they were drinking was going to stay in the gut, in their intestines, and treat those bugs that were in there. There are side effects in humans associated with this, and they tend to be jaw pain and things like that because of the changes in bone density that they cause.
Right.
We don't see any of those effects in the mice.
I see.
It is important to note that the mice don't particularly like the flavor of the water too much. These compounds aren't particularly tasty, so they avoid drinking it as much as possible, which is causing us some problems right now, but we're working around them.
Maybe a little lemon flavoring would help.
Actually, we just decided to add some sucrose to them, and maybe some citric acid. We'll try to get it nice and tasty so that they'll take their proper medicines.
They'll think they're drinking Sprite.
Something like that, yes.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good plan and pretty easy solution. Matt and Scott, I would think that a discovery like this would be really attracting all kinds of support and should be on the ultimate fast track to translation to clinical practice. Given the crisis with antibiotic resistance that we've discussed already, and given the fact that these drugs are already approved. You know, in the hospital setting particularly, as we've alluded to, you just hear people expressing real desperation that, you know, they get a spreading infection and they're running out of weapons to do anything about it.
Right. So we've actually heard from clinicians. I think we're up to every continent except for Antarctica that are just curious about the research and want to know more. And, you know, we're basic scientists, so we send them all the data that we have. And, you know, and it's up to the clinicians to decide to use these drugs, what are called off-label. But I think it's important to point out that the two clinically approved compounds are effective. But we have many other chemicals that we've discovered and are working on that have slightly different effects, and some are better profiles in terms of being able to kill these bacteria more effectively and so forth. So we're enthusiastic to move forward with those in a variety of ways.
I see.
So there's not a clinical trial that I'm aware of that's been developed yet on this. As you said, we published this about 2 months ago, so it's
in its infancy.
It really is, yeah. And things, you know, you always hear, oh, this is a really nice discovery, but, you know, how quickly, oh, it'll be years. And the reality is it really does have to be years, unfortunately.
Of course.
Although we can, I know that this is being used in some patients
just
to try.
That was my next question. You know? Anecdotally, you know, has anyone tried these drugs in humans at this point, given that the clinician could do so perfectly legally on a, as you say, off-label basis?
So I'm aware of some patients that are trying this, and I haven't heard yet about outcomes, but you know, this is such an important problem that You know, people are very willing to sort of try new things, especially if they're safe drugs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wish I knew more about how things were going, but we don't yet. But yes, we know that that clinicians are trying this.
And is the government falling in place behind this? You know, again, I think this should be on a very fast track, and I would think that, you know, the support would be just kind of flooding in, I would hope.
So we're certainly working on that. The NIH has called bacterial infections orphan diseases, which is actually a really good classification from their point of view. They're saying that, you know, these are ones that
they'll fund it at that point.
That's right, that mm-hmm. they're not, you know, in the mainstream of the cancer or the diabetes type research, heart disease, which are all very important, but these are ones that are also killing people. So mm-hmm. This is in that orphan class, and so we're working very hard on getting some support to continue this work.
I see. Well, what about interest from pharmaceutical companies? You know, both of these, the drugs that you've been using up to this point, are both long since off patent.
That's right.
Is there any incentive for pharma to get involved with this, or is it strictly going to be up to the government with the orphan status as you've described?
So I think it's important to say that more and more the discovery phase of drug discovery is being done in smaller companies and in academic labs. We're certainly cognizant of that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really the reason we got into this, but it's one of the reasons we're glad we got into it, is that we feel like we can make discoveries and then work with the pharmaceutical industry to move them forward. We have talked to many big pharma companies about this. They're certainly very interested. What we chose to do through UNC was to do our own small startup company, uh-huh. which is now in place, and we're working on moving these discoveries forward, furthering the animal studies, moving the other drugs that we've discovered, the other compounds that we've discovered forward, and checking on their profiles, and trying to work this into a real viable new treatment.
I see. So this could be eventually something where you develop a whole library of potential compounds that address this mechanism.
That's exactly right. And one of the...
And then that would be the time for big pharma to
that's
potentially
right.
step
yeah,
in.
That's, I think that's typically the mindset that you go into. Mm-hmm. I should point out that we've worked quite extensively with the standard laboratory strains of E. coli and other typical bacteria. Mm-hmm. A high importance project in the lab is to take now a variety of really dangerous clinical isolates and infectious bacteria that we can acquire and check the efficacy there, and we see good effects on some of those strains that we've looked at.
Well, what are some of the strains you're looking at?
Well, certainly ones that we want to look carefully at are things like Staph aureus. You know, staph infections are, I don't think anybody would be surprised to hear just how critical those are.
Mm-hmm. And those are really the big killers in the hospital setting.
It's really that one and another one called Acinetobacter, mm-hmm. which is one that's just very drug resistant, and so are the staph strains. So those are ones we're really looking at closely. Pseudomonas is another one, mm-hmm. both in CF patients and then just in previously healthy patients, where they go septic and get infected. So, you know, unfortunately, there's no shortage of bacteria that we should go and look at. Mm-hmm. I do want to point out that that TB, the Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which causes there's 2 billion people in the world that are infected by this. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. this is about the only strain that we're aware of that doesn't use this conjugation mechanism to acquire resistance. Yeah, turns out their cell walls are really thick. That's one of the reasons they're so hard to kill. And because they're so thick, they don't come up against one another as closely as they need to actually do this efficiently. Mm-hmm. So that's one where we're actually looking at other targets to try to get at those bacteria. But in terms of the relaxase approach, unfortunately, that one's not going to be able to nail TB. But there are a lot of other ones out there that we're going to be able to hopefully get after.
Well, I mean, maybe it was hoping for too much that there would be this one silver bullet mechanism that would be universally applicable, and it sounds like something that's going to keep Scott busy in the lab for a while.
Sounds like it.
Why do you think, Scott, that no one had taken this particular approach before? You know, it sounds, although it's I'm so impressed with how brilliant it all was. It doesn't sound like that big a leap that someone hadn't already taken a look at this, a long time ago.
So conjugative systems were actually discovered quite a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
And in large part, a lot of the studies on them were done within 20 or 30 years of their discovery, and that was back in the 1950s. So the number of labs that have been looking at these conjugative systems has decreased over time. We have some very good friends who've collaborated with us, Diane Taylor, Laura Frost, Steve Mattson. These are all very good labs that have been looking into this problem,
mm-hmm.
and without whom we couldn't have done what we did, especially the Mattson lab, who's been a great help to us.
Are they at other institutions?
Laura Frost and Diane Taylor, both up in Alberta.
Uh-huh.
And Steve Mattson is actually just right across the street from us in the biology department.
I see. Okay, well, so this is not, there's obviously, as is so often the case, a lot of collaboration.
Well, that's very much true. That's very true. I think that other people didn't look at this necessarily because the mutational studies, the genetic studies that were done to help start looking at the mechanism before the structures came out were brand new when we first got into this a few years ago.
I see.
So the data's really only been out there for the last couple of years.
Okay, okay.
Otherwise, I'm sure people would have targeted it in the past.
So is this something that has benefited from the technological advances in sequencing and things like that?
Oh, I think everything in our field really has.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what we do couldn't be done 20 or 30 years ago.
Right, right. My guests on Radio In Vivo today are Matt Redenbaugh and Scott Lujan from UNC, and we have been discussing a pretty important discovery they had made regarding antibiotic resistance and hopefully a way to combat it. Matt and Scott, the discovery we've been discussing emerged from your research in structural biology, as we've talked about. I'd kind of like to take a step back for just a minute and get you to tell us exactly what that discipline is. What's it all about? And why is it important?
So structural biology is sort of a discipline in biology where you look at the atomic structure of macromolecules, and what we mean by that is proteins and DNA and RNA and things like that. And so what you get from that is that atomic level picture that in many cases really helps you to understand how a protein functions. And I do sort of tell people that in many ways I got into this because I wasn't smart enough to do anything else in biology. And what you really do...
I understand you used to be an English major like me.
That's right. That's right. So what you do is you make a picture, And so to me, a picture is something you can look at and really think about. And that provides you some sort of solid ground on which to sort of make some predictions. And it's just a wonderful example. What Scott has been talking about is just a great example of doing that. You know, mm-hmm. he looked at these pictures, and not just his picture, but he mentioned the other labs at Johns Hopkins and in Spain. And he looked at all those pictures, and he thought deeply about those things, and that's when he made his prediction. So that's where structural biology kind of fits as a way to provide some real detail.
So it's really a combination of understanding of the structures, but also understanding on the chemical level, the potential functionality that could be happening of the various reactions that could be taking place and covalences and things like that.
That's right. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all really chemists. Mm-hmm. we're looking at these things. They might be biochemical molecules, but we're chemists. We're thinking about, how they fit together and how they perform their reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And that provides you that sort of insight. And again, Scott's a great example of taking those insights and moving forward with them.
Sure. What kind of tools are you using these days? I know X-ray crystallography has been around for decades. Is that not what was used to solve the structure of DNA back in the 50s?
That's right, yeah.
How is the technology evolved since then?
So that is, so X-ray crystallography is the method that we're using. And just so your listeners understand, it's essentially taking a crystal, which is just like, you know, a grain of table salt. But instead of it being sodium chloride, it's a bunch of protein molecules, for example, if it's a protein crystal. Mm-hmm. And you put that in a strong X-ray beam, and it diffracts the X-rays into spots. And you take those spots, and you do some math, and you figure out where all the atoms are. And as you said, yes, this is a method that's been around for a long time, discovered sort of about 1910,
okay.
You know, moved into the macromolecule stage in about the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a sort of a workhorse method. The way that it's changed is just the technology's gotten, you know, much, much better. And we collect all of our diffraction data now at big particle accelerators called synchrotrons that have really bright X-ray beams. And we do the data collections in seconds rather than hours and days, which is what it used to take. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my day, you know, I'm sort of quite the old man in the laboratory. And in my day, you know, it took...
You're pretty young to be the old man of the laboratory.
Well, you know, they still don't let me forget it. You know, it took, you could get an entire PhD just sort of working out the final structure. And now my students and postdocs do it on their laptops.
Wow.
And it takes, you know, hours to just a few days. And so, you know, it allows us to do the types of things that Scott is doing, which is, you know, not just stopping with that structure and then making some guesses. You know, he thinks and he makes guesses and he tests and, you know, it all can kind of come together.
Mm-hmm. And it can ultimately come together to be something important that actually has biological implications. Right?
If we do our job right.
There you go. Well, you talk about the evolution of the tools, and I'm sure that involves increased resolution, and I'm sure, you know, the computer and software development has totally changed the picture for you as well.
Oh, definitely. In fact, even in my tenure in the lab, which has only been a few years, the whole software situation has changed quite a lot. And the younger students coming in are learning on newer software than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually a little behind the times now and have to retrain here before I leave. And but it becomes easier and easier all the time to do this. And the tricky part becomes the thought behind it rather than the acquisition of the data.
Right, which is the case throughout science these days.
Yeah.
Well, what types of new questions do these improvements in the tools allow you to pursue today that might not have been possible in the past 5, 10, 20 years ago? And we'll bring the old man back for that.
That's right, yeah. You can hear my knees creaking as I sort of roll back in. So it's a question of scale, and it's a question of speed. You know, you can solve many more structures much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You can solve larger structures of more important complexes. You know, the ribosome, which makes protein in the cell. This was something that, you know, we've been studying biochemically for 50 years. And when the final, you know, very high resolution detailed structures of those came out, you know, it was a sort of a major aha moment. And that really just advances things forward quite quickly. So, you know, for the drug discovery process, you can, you know, look at a lead, you know, an initial hit in terms of screening is called a lead. And then you can do that in complex with your target, your protein,
mm-hmm.
and figure out right away, you know, what change do you need to make to that lead? How can you make this drug better? And, you know, that cycle is much easier now than it used to be.
I see. And that has been a trend in the pharmaceutical industry as well, of refining some of the existing drugs chemically so that they are more potent and perhaps have less side effects, right?
That's exactly right, yeah.
What types of collaborations and interdisciplinary work do you folks do? Is structural biology, for example, an important element in systems biology?
It absolutely is. I mean, structural biology really cannot function on its own. You know, the strength of of our ability to do science at UNC is directly tied to our ability to collaborate. Scott mentioned Steve Mattson across the street, a wonderful colleague, has been a huge help on this project. Mm-hmm. Just on the same project, we now are working with a scientist called Balfour Sartor, who's an infectious disease, or excuse me, an irritable bowel system, irritable bowel disease scientist and doctor who treats Crohn's disease, and he runs this facility with these mice, these notobiotic mice. And so, you know, his support of this project has been critical. Mm-hmm. We have chemists that are helping us out, Mike Cremins, who's making new molecules based on our discoveries. And so, you know, to say systems biology really is correct, that we're all studying the detailed biology of systems. And certainly what we're trying to do fits right in with that.
I see. My guests on Radio In Vivo today are Matt Redenbow and Scott Lujan from UNC. And they are structural biologists. And we've been learning all about structural biology and why it is so important and their work with antibiotic resistance. But Matt, don't run away, because I want to talk to you about some of your earlier work. Which is also quite significant. Tell us about your discoveries regarding drug metabolizing enzymes and this so-called promiscuous enzyme called PXR.
So this is this was some of the first work that the laboratory did. So PXR is actually a receptor, and what it does is detect the presence of compounds in your liver. And what we didn't discover, but we helped to sort of explain, is that it's essentially a drug receptor. It's a xenobiotic receptor, compounds from the outside of the organism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we're always under kind of an onslaught of those kind of chemicals in your food, and so forth, and even in the drugs that you take.
Absolutely.
And your body has to monitor for those. And so this receptor sits inside your cells, and it waits for potentially harmful compounds to come along. And when it finds one, it turns on the expression of a whole set of genes that then make the enzymes, which are the catalytic muscle.
Genes like PON1?
PON1, cytochrome, yes.
See, he keeps up.
Cytochrome P450s, all those things that degrade those drugs. And so this is kind of the master regulator of all those guys. And so what our lab did was work out the crystal structure, work out the atomic structure of this, and mm-hmm. begin to explain how it can work promiscuously. So most things in biology are very specific.
Right.
Typically you learn, one enzyme, one substrate. You know, they're very specific. And these mm-hmm. protective systems can't be that specific, so they're called promiscuous. And so we tried to explain how this single protein can bind to very small drugs like phenobarbital and really huge drugs like rifampicin or Taxol. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, we begin to understand, how our protective systems work.
And then that's vitally important also, because I know that there's a lot of person-to-person variation in how those systems work.
That's absolutely true. And one of the things that we're most excited about is being able to actually shut down these systems when you're treating somebody, for example, with a cancer drug. Mm-hmm. Most of the 95% at least of any drug that you take is metabolized and excreted right away.
Right.
A lot of times those metabolites cause side effects and are nasty. So what we're trying to think about is, if somebody's taking tamoxifen, for example, for a breast tumor, mm-hmm. Could we give them a drug at the same time that shuts down this PXR receptor, represses it? You can give a lower dose then of the tamoxifen and have it go through and actually have more of it get to the tumor and have more efficacy. And we're actually really delighted that we have now some leads and some compounds that seem to do that. And again, they're approved, and there's ways we can start to move forward on that.
Well, that is potentially, extremely significant. It seems like.
And again, it's a great example of really great collaboration. So we're teamed up with a whole variety of people internationally on this. But the key player in terms of shutting down this drug detection is a clinician named Sridhar Mani up at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. And he actually has a small clinical trial going now just examining, how much can you repress this receptor's function, and then how does that affect the metabolism of another drug.
I see. Now, is that work in animals, or is that going on in humans?
Well, he's
doing
that in humans, because these are actually clinically approved compounds, and he can enroll, a handful of patients and see what the effects are in humans.
I see. And what is the mechanism for shutting down that receptor?
So what we're looking at is, you know, not to get into too much sort of molecular speak, but the way this receptor works is it binds to a drug in a hole, in a cavity inside itself.
Uh-huh.
But then its real job is just to recruit a bunch of other proteins in the cell, and that's how they turn on genes. And so what we've targeted is the surface of this receptor where it recruits the other proteins. And we found that we can disrupt that recruitment. And so really, the disruption becomes drug-dependent. That's what we wanted, that, you know, it only would work if you already had tamoxifen there. And what we found is that tamoxifen binds to the inside of the protein, gets it ready to go, but our second drug binds to the surface and shuts it down. And it only binds to the surface when tamoxifen is around. And so it's a real sort of push and pull, and together, hopefully, we can have that effect.
So the treatment is able to be specific for the adjunct, for the drug treatment.
That's right.
As opposed to let's shut this system down, which of course would leave the individual highly vulnerable to the toxins we're all exposed
to. That's right. Very scary. So one of the things we're excited about is we do this in patients that are taking these treatments as outpatient treatments, but highly controlled. In other words, you don't go home and, you know, inject yourself with Taxol. You know, you go and you have your chemo treatment, and at the same time, you know, a clinician or a healthcare giver could monitor what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of the mode that we're thinking about for this.
I see. Well, I'm sure that would be a very welcomed adjunct in terms of making cancer therapies more effective.
I mean, that's exactly our mindset.
Yeah, that's great. Tell me a little bit about, I know when this work first came out, you published that it was potentially useful for cocaine overdose and as a protectant against nerve agents such as sarin and things like that.
So this is a related, it's in the same cadre of projects, but it's sort of a related protein. So this is actually a protein that PXR controls the expression of.
I see.
And this is a separate enzyme called carboxylesterase 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that we've all got churning around in our liver, and it helps to protect us from chemical threats. And it's one of the ways that both heroin and cocaine are metabolized and excreted in humans. And actually, my wife's family sort of would give me a hard time saying that if you Googled promiscuous and cocaine, you'd get my website, which, you know, I, of course, was always wondering why they were Googling promiscuous and cocaine. But
yeah, that's a good question, too. Absolutely.
But, you know, so we looked at that enzyme and we actually figured out how it metabolizes cocaine and how it processes heroin. And then we're taking the next steps to try to engineer a protein-based therapeutic that could be given in an emergency department for somebody who's overdosed on cocaine. And that way it would flow through their bloodstream, and it's actually safe in the bloodstream and clear cocaine. And then the U.S. Army for years has been trying to come up with a protein-based prophylactic, you know, something you could give a frontline personnel that might be at risk for nerve agent exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, you know, if they are exposed, then this would help to catalytically remove it, to process it and get rid of it. And one of the proteins...
So it'd be protective.
That's right.
Okay.
One of the proteins they were interested in was this carboxylesterase 1 enzyme. And so we now have crystal structures in collaboration with the Army where we've got the actual nerve agents bound into the active site, the active region of the protein. And we're now making changes to the protein itself. And we've actually generated a pretty efficient already in our first round of mutants, a pretty efficient what's called a nerve agent hydrolase, you know, an enzyme that degrades nerve agents. And so we're moving forward as quickly as we can on that and trying to give the Army a therapeutic that they might be able to use both for their personnel and for first responders to any sort of attack using chemical weapons.
I see. Absolutely. Well, that also would be of great value because there really is nothing like that at this point, right?
I mean, there are treatments for nerve agent exposure. They work not so well.
After the fact.
They're therapeutics, not prophylactics. Mm-hmm. They in many cases will save a patient, but they don't completely eliminate all the side effects that go with a nerve agent exposure. And so there's some long-term effects. And so certainly, you know, added muscle to that problem would certainly be welcome.
Absolutely. Well, Matt, more recently, another part of your work I wanted to ask about, you and your colleagues published a paper about the evolution of the glucocorticoid receptor, tying this modern protein all the way back through its many mutations to a creature that lived 450 million years ago. At least we assume that.
That's right.
Tell us about that work. That's fascinating.
So this is another great example of a great collaboration. So there's a really talented scientist named Joe Thornton at the University of Oregon who has developed methods to resurrect the sequences of proteins from long since extinct organisms. And what he does is he does it statistically. He looks at all of the modern examples of, for example, this glucocorticoid receptor, which is your cortisol sensor. It senses stress hormones. Mm-hmm. And it evolved, you know, from a last common precursor 450 million years ago. And Joe did all this wonderful work where he traced sort of the evolutionary path to that last precursor of this molecule. And then what Joe did was he made that molecule in the lab, and he showed that it actually was active. It responded to the hormones that we predicted existed back then. And then
let me make sure I understand you here, because this is amazing. He traced this back and found this precursor molecule.
In silico, in a computer.
Right. So nothing that we have an actual sample of coming out
of. This was not Jurassic Park.
Cave in Kenya somewhere or something. So he statistically figured this out and then actually physically made the molecule, and it turned out to be active as predicted.
That's right. He synthesized
the
gene.
That is remarkable.
Yeah.
It is kind of Jurassic Park in a way.
It is in the sense, except that the sort of, you know, taking the blood out of the mosquito in the amber was not done that way. It was done all in the computer.
Sure.
Synthesized the gene, made the protein, and it functioned the way he predicted it was.
Wow.
And that it would.
Mm-hmm.
And then where we got involved was he called us up and said, well, why don't you solve the crystal structure, the molecular structure of this protein? And so we did. And we looked at it in complex with a lot of different hormones. And then he said, okay, let's do the hard thing. Let's do what scientists do all the time, which is try to figure out how a protein evolved. But to date, before we started our work, everybody had to do that looking backwards. In other words, you look at the modern protein and you sort of guess, okay, how did it get to where it is now?
Uh-huh.
What this gave us an opportunity to do was stand 450 million years ago and look forward.
Wow.
And say, okay, you know, what were the changes that allowed this precursor to go along one path toward the glucocorticoid receptor and along another path toward another receptor called the mineralocorticoid receptor.
Uh-huh.
And what we found was that you had to make, obviously, mutations to make changes, but you had to do them in a very specific order. And in fact, some of the most important mutations didn't have any effect on the protein that we could measure, but what it did was set the protein up for later mutations that had to happen in a certain order.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is all sort of kind of deep thinking, but what it really allowed us to do was walk that evolutionary path. And what we found was that evolution is really a knife edge. Most mutations aren't productive. In fact, many of them are deleterious, and so you fall off that knife edge. But, you know, life was able to walk this path, and it had to do it in a very precise order. And it got to the sort of, you know, next step in evolution, which was about 420 million years ago. And then the next one after that, about 400 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in each case,
mm-hmm.
you get a new function. Right. And you can do it with a very specific set of mutations.
And so you've been able to actually document what those mutations were.
That's right.
And has that been confirmed by looking at actual physical samples?
Still not. I mean, all these organisms are still, you know, long since extinct.
Yeah.
My collaborator Joe says, you know, that this organism is the last common ancestor between you and a salmon.
Right.
So, but what the sort of aha that we got from it was that evolution was not deterministic. You know,
right.
you could actually think about rolling back the tape of life to 450 million years ago, and there may have been a different path that it took. It found a path that, didn't end up with the modern GR and MR. It ended up somewhere else. And so, you know, we all think about the evolution to, you know, this highly evolved creature that is us, but really, you know, evolution was this wonderful chance event that we were lucky enough to benefit from.
Sure, and a long, long series of chance events.
That's right.
Indeed. Well, gentlemen, we are kind of getting close to the end of our hour, and I don't want to run out of time today without fulfilling my promise to you, Matt, that we would spend some time talking about the importance of mentor-mentee relationships in academia and in science. I know you've got a whole slew of mentees there in the Redenbaugh lab, many of whom we hope are listening this morning. Why is this relationship so vital and so important? And Scott, we're gonna get your answer to that.
Well,
being the beneficiary.
Well, one of the things is that the personality of the mentor and the mentee really have to fit together. Matt and I work well together in part because he allows you as much independence as you can get away with and be productive doing it, which is an environment in which a lot of us flourish. And one thing that happens is that the lab tends to select for people who fit with the personality of the mentor, mm-hmm. and can learn the most that way. And I think it's really showing some fruits over the last couple of years.
Oh, well, absolutely, based on our conversation today. Matt, from your perspective, I know that you're a great believer in this. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what I really wanted people to understand was that, you know, I'm a scientific manager. I'm helping these students and postdocs, do science and learn how to do science. But that the actual work is done by them, and I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that, and that it really is Scott's intelligence and effort and drive here that was a major component of what he achieved. But as Scott said, you know, it really is, it's a partnership. You know, we are colleagues. You know, it's my job at the end of the day to make sure that things get done, but, you know, I do it with them, and I learn as much from them as hopefully they learn from me.
Sure.
And that's the way, you know, at the end of the day, what I really produce is people. You know, I produce scientists that then go on and make other discoveries. They work in industry. They go on and train other people. And, mm-hmm. and you know, that's a really central part of what an academic scientist does.
Yeah, absolutely. And the types of discoveries we've been talking about today, although the credit certainly gets shared widely, not only within your lab, but with all the collaborators, as you've discussed, and authorship of papers gets shared. But still, somebody has to have that first spark, and setting up the conditions to generate it, that I'm sure that is, in fact, a big part of your job.
That really is. You know, I have to find a way to communicate to them, you know, what's interesting, what's important. I give them suggestions about how to get there. In many cases, those suggestions aren't the ones that got them to where they needed to go. But it's just sparking, you know, well, maybe think about it this way or maybe try that. And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's really, that's where the partnership comes in. And it's really a give and take, and we try to move forward. And in every one of the projects I talked about today, you know, it was a big group of people in which I was sort of in a management role.
Well, Matt and Scott, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Radio In Vivo today and hear about all your exciting work on antibiotic resistance and other contributions from the world of structural biology. And we've got some terrific guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. Check the website, radioinvivo.net, and join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. See you next time. I'm the operator.